Welcome to the Rethinking Revenue Podcast, where CEOs, revenue leaders, investors, and go-to-market experts share hard-fought lessons of success and failure as they've prepared their businesses to evolve beyond the status quo. Now, let's meet your co-hosts, Ed Porter and James Roris. Ed is a fractional chief revenue officer and founder of Blue Chip CRO. He helps CEOs fix revenue problems inside marketing, sales, and customer success teams. James is a CRO's secret weapon, creator of Wins Selling. He helps revenue leaders simplify sales success by developing cross-functional go-to-market teams and establishing certified sales pipelines. Thanks for tuning in. Enjoy the show.
All right. We are back with another episode of Rethinking Revenue. With me, as always, my partner in crime, James Roris. James emailed me today because he recognized that it is a sunny day. It's going to be nice here in Columbus, Ohio. And he asked if I would be enjoying a cigar today. So unfortunately, that answer is no. I'm getting ready to head on a plane later today to Chicago, where it will actually be 66 tomorrow. So it will be warm in the Windy City, but then Wednesday it will be like 40. So that's what happens. But anyway, James, so have you been outside today? Have you walked? Have you had your walking cigar?
Absolutely, man. You have to take advantage of these beautiful days. And I've got lots of choices to choose from in the humidor. So I am looking forward to it, to today and the spring, for sure.
Yes. And daylight savings is less than a month away, which is exciting. Yeah. So this is good. Our February gray wasn't so bad. It was actually full of a lot of sunlight here in Columbus. So happy about that. So we're excited to talk to our guest here. Our guest has been a friend of both James and I, and he's doing some really cool things, not only just with the company, but one of the new products that's come out that I'm really excited to see continue to grow. So we are here with Bill Balderas, and I'll turn it over to you, Bill. Tell us about you, the company, the role you serve, and tell us about the customers you serve.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate both of you having me on. Really good to see both of you, your faces, hear your voices today. Yes, Bill Balderas. I've been in Columbus since the mid-late 90s, always in a startup and entrepreneurial type role. So I've been an entrepreneur since 2006. I've started, built, sold, invested in, worked with probably 20 different companies in that time. So it's definitely in my blood and about the only thing I'm wired to do. Futurity, the company we have today. Yeah, essentially, we saw an opportunity almost 10 years ago. This is 2024 will be our 10-year anniversary. But we looked across the marketing landscape and we said, you know who's doing really great at marketing? It's companies like Netflix, who know what you're going to watch before you know you want to watch it. And companies like Spotify, who knows what band you're going to like before you do. Or Amazon, who knows what you want to buy before you buy it. And we realized none of these companies were known for having great branding or logos, or they really focused on having great data, predicting how your customers would behave and then communicating with them. And our job is, let's help everyone do that. So let's take that knowledge and technology to a broader world. Now, we specifically tend to focus on regulated industries. So hospitals, healthcare, pharmaceutical, med devices, government, finance, essentially organizations where their data is really sensitive. Most folks can't touch that data. And so we go through things like HIPAA training. We're currently going through SOC 2 compliance. We have cameras in our office. So it's a organization that has really sensitive data. They want to draw insights from that data. They have lots, you know, we're generally talking terabytes of data, millions of rows of data, and they want to use that to communicate with their audiences better. So if you want to improve patient engagement or patient acquisitions or efficacy in clinical trials, or we work with a lot of social causes in government like transit, zoning, infant mortality, the opioid epidemic, the data's out there. We can help you fashion, use that data, predict how people behave, and fashion just the right communication strategies. And what that led us to, as Ed alluded to, about coming up on more like 3 years ago, coming in the depths of COVID, we knew we had the opportunity to take that time to work on something new and different. And we also found whenever we engaged with a client, whether it was a bank or a government agency or a hospital, we would initially start by understanding their existing audience. So who are their patients? Who are their donors? Who are their constituents? And that would require getting a lot of data on those folks. And they were kind of the big data providers out there, but they were slow. They were a little expensive. We couldn't get the data we needed. And we thought, someone has to have a software product where I can just upload all my customers. And in a few minutes, I know everything about those customers, their age, their income, their demographics, their sports, their hobbies, you know, wealth information, physical address, that sort of thing. And we found that product didn't exist. So we developed Huckle a few years back. the initial version, you know, we had about 36 data points on our audiences. It worked well. It was a nice to have persona builder. And then a couple of things happened in the last year. First, Google said, we're going to get rid of third-party cookies on Chrome. And so if you do any kind of online advertising, whether you know it or not, you depend on those cookies. That's where, Ed, if you look at a pair of shoes, and then the next time you get online, you see ads for that pair of shoes everywhere. The good news is a consumer, it's going to go away. The bad news is if you're the guy selling shoes, this is terrible, because how do you sell shoes now?
Right.
So Huckle fills that gap by knowing Ed's in the market for shoes because of other behavior and serves him ads, emails, other messaging. So on one hand, Google created chaos in the market that's now grown to some pretty explosive growth to us. The other thing, as I'm sure all your guests talk about, is AI technology is now easy and affordable and works really well. And so by building AI, and we can now say, James, give us your 10,000 best customers. And in a few minutes, we are crafting emails and Instagram ads and Facebook ads, targeting those customers based on hundreds of data points that we uncover about who your ideal audience is. And that's us in a nutshell.
Wow. Bill, what made you stop at these three opportunities? this is outstanding. I don't know where to start, but I think the thing that I'm most curious about is the pivot that you made around measuring intent and kind of turning that opportunity that Google presented to you into something potentially very big. Give us a sense of how you differentiate yourselves from other data sources and other AI providers. I think one of the challenges that a lot of folks think about today is that their experience of AI has been pretty rudimentary, and especially in the context of marketing and communicating with customers, a lot of us struggle with the obvious, right? I had somebody reach out to me the other day responding to an email I sent him, and he asked, you know, what's your AI? What AI tool are you using?
Oh, gosh.
Just because I had done some research before I reached out to him. But
right.
You know, I'm just curious what your experience there is.
Sure. A couple of things we really focus on. So one is the model is only as good as what it's trained on. I'm doing a presentation tomorrow morning where we talk about data for good. And there's this idea, well, we're going to have AI in the criminal justice system because now we'll have fair sentencing. But you're training that AI on historically unfair sentencing. So you know, example like these, if you're, you know, traditionally, people of color get longer prison sentences. And so you're training AI on a bad system to make objective decisions, or with banking or lending or school admissions. So part of it is AI is often trained on a bad or subjective data set, and then we expect it to be objective. That's an issue. With Huckle, the beauty is we are training it. You give us 10,000 of your customers. We know your customers are primarily single moms over 40 who make more than $100,000 a year, have two kids, are caring for an elderly parent, go to the gym three times a week, and buy a lot of sporting equipment. So that data is solid. We know that by looking at things like their shopper cards, their loyalty cards, the apps they use. And so now you're building an AI model saying, this is your ideal buyer. This is who spends the most money at your restaurant, or is most likely to have a child admitted to your university, or most likely to seek care at your hospital. And so you're training that AI on a system versus probably most of the hospital systems we work with said, yeah, I saw an AI system. I typed in the goals of my campaign and what services I offer, and then it created a bunch of crappy ads. Yeah, that's, you know, you're giving it prompts. It's trained on a general data set. We're training it on a data set that's specific to your customers. That's one of the beautiful things. The other thing is, because we embrace the regulated environment, most people don't. As soon as you say you have patient data or HIPAA,
they stay away.
Or SOC 2, they love working with retail, e-commerce, that sort of thing. But as soon as you talk about government data, patient data, financial data, most organizations don't want to touch that. Whereas we think that's where there's the greatest chance to do good.
Is that you kind of mentioned this in your intro about those regulated industries. Was that something that you honed in on during this creation of, or I guess maybe it's call it your pivot from third-party cookies to now trying to AI? Is that when you decided to tackle that, or did you dabble or want to try and support that industry prior to that?
Sure. We did get started in that a little before. And I know the whole purpose of your podcast around, you know, rethinking revenue. We did have one of those pivots where, historically, we almost never lose a client. We can get in there, we use the data, we produce the campaigns, we generate revenue. So we almost never lose a client. About a year ago, we lost two clients. Now in an agency world, a lot of it's based on churn, but for us, our growth is based on never losing a client and everything's additive. When we had that churn, and then I was looking at our win-loss record, I thought, man, some of the deals that are not working out for us. We're seeing these trends in non-regulated industries where it's just extremely price competitive. So you have this kind of race to the bottom. For example, on paid search campaigns, you know, typically if you have a person who's highly educated and involved in strategic managing your paid search campaign, you might be paying 10 to 12% of media spend. What we are seeing is either companies using AI or using a kind of Google self-service features, that's called PMax specifically, or hiring, you know, low paid or offshore resources. And you see that that market start to, the bottom start to drop out of that market. You see some of these services getting really devalued. And what we looked at from a revenue perspective is that who needs white glove services? Who is there no room for error? So if I'm selling you, you know, this, so I know we're not video, but I guess, you know, a soda can, a drink, whatever. If I sell a few less sodas that week or a few less t-shirts, it's not a matter of life or death. In a hospital situation or healthcare, it could be clinical trial situation. So who has an incentive to want white glove services, highly trained teams, lots of tools? And we decided, and we already had a pretty good foundation in healthcare anyway. And we thought, you know, those clients never leave us. Those clients stay with us forever. When we do surveys, they're our happiest clients. And so Huckle was part of that pivot. The software was part of that pivot. But I would say, you know, Huckle was more of a, wasn't the pivot in and of itself. It was part of this bigger pivot to say, where do we do the best work? Who sees the value in that work? Who are the clients that never, ever leave us? And we determined it's those regulated industries. Where are places where we see, you know, prices crashing, where we see, you know, clients, quite frankly, that aren't the right fit for us and we're not the right fit for them. And it was some of those less regulated or less complex industries.
Great stuff. I love it, Ed, that in this show, we typically are talking with entrepreneurs and leaders who talk about not only their own pivot or ways of rethinking revenue, but also how they're helping their clients rethink revenue. And so, Bill, another level of depth here, which is really cool. I'd love to go back to how you help the market and how you help your clients. And I think this idea of data, it's been around for a long time. And it's really amazing to me that how poorly we do with it and how long it's taken us to get good at it. I guess I'd love to have you just kind of help any kind of business leader, marketing leader, revenue leader who's listening, think about what they should be, how they should be resetting their mindset around data, around the use of technology like AI, just based on some of the interactions you've had with the leaders in the industries that you're working with. Because my experience in healthcare is that there's a huge requirement there, but you know what? Those guys are, a lot of hospitals are back in the 90s in terms of the technology they're leveraging. A lot of regulated industries are really slow to adapt and adopt. How are you seeing their mindset shift and how are you guiding them as you work with them?
Sure. So there's historically, and again, even though data and AI and analytics has been around a while, it's truly just been the last few years that it's everywhere. So you can trace, I think the word neural network is first used in like the 20s or 30s, but that's kind of pedantic. Realistically, this is a very young industry. And I think up until the last year, use of data and analytics, I compare it to, it's like taking a multivitamin and going to the gym. You should do it. You know, it's generally good for you, but it's not necessarily going to help you tomorrow. Now, you know, it's a long-term play. And so organizations that were proactive, that were willing to invest, because it wasn't always super easy to get to, it was kind of expensive. Before tools like OpenAI, this stuff wasn't as accessible. So it was kind of a little bit reserved for companies that were really proactive and had the luxury of investing and exploring. What's happened in the last year or 6 months is it's become an aspirin instead of a multivitamin. So it's, I have a headache right now and I need this headache to go away. And so I have to take an aspirin right now. And there's a few things driving that. One is just this generally regulated environment. So even if you're not in healthcare, there's privacy regulations in every state. There are security regulations in every state. There's GDPR. California has some really strict rules. But essentially, there are things going on within the data governance world that require companies to act. So I mentioned third-party cookies already. If you are a small business owner that, you know, dry cleaner, and you spend $200 a month on Facebook ads, you're probably going to see that performance tank very quickly in the next few months, because without those third-party cookies, Facebook doesn't know who needs dry cleaning services. So now it becomes a headache. It's, yeah, it'd be nice if my Facebook ads were a little better, but now it's my dry cleaning store was dependent on these ads in this business, and now it's going away. So now I have a headache. I need to use data better. In a few months, on July 2nd, Google is going to delete all the historical Google Analytics data from every website that's on the old version of Analytics, which is most of the internet. And so if you have any kind of data retention policy saying you will keep your website data for 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, you are out of compliance on July 2nd. So that's a headache. If you're a vendor that does work with the government, you probably signed a contract saying you'll keep your website data for so many years. And on July 2nd, you will be out of compliance and then you put that contract at risk. If you are a nonprofit that requires you to keep your website data, if you are work in finance or law, you probably have that. So if you're a two-person law firm, you probably have a data retention policy. So now this becomes a headache and I need to solve that problem. HIPAA is, there's a big dispute right now raging between Google and CMS, the federal government group that regulates HIPAA. So you have these two behemoths, the federal government and Google, fighting over whether Google Analytics is HIPAA compliant. And so there was a recent study that said 99% of every hospital system in the country is out of compliance with HIPAA. And HIPAA fines are, measured in the tens of thousands of dollars per occurrence. So these are, multi-million dollar lawsuits. That's a headache. So part of what has driven our business is this shift from, there are immediate things I have to respond to in 2024. 2024 is the year of the headache. It's the time whatever your business is, you probably have to respond. That's the negative stuff. Here's the positive stuff. The positive stuff is OpenAI is free or cheap. Tools like Google BigQuery relational database is free or cheap. The ability to get information on your customers went from a few dollars per person a few years ago to a few cents per person this year. And so the accessibility to data, the accessibility to AI, the accessibility to these tools has just dropped drastically to the point that if you are a solopreneur running a small business, you can be using data really, really effectively today.
So is this the, I don't want to queue it up, so feel free to talk about another topic, but is this kind of what the queue up for rethinking revenue is? Is this pivot that you made with Huckle? Yes. Or is there something? Okay, good. Yeah. So I want to dive into this. I got a couple questions to try and find this out. From what I know and fill in some blanks is that Huckle was initially created to provide some consumer data, to append consumer data to companies selling to consumers. And voila, exactly like what you said is you can just upload your data, you'll append it, and they could get better targeting, a lot better marketing. So that was the idea of it. So was it when you kind of first heard about this whole third-party cookie going away where you were, was this your oh shit moment of what do we do? How do we do it? Was that kind of the point? And then talk us through what your thought process was or how you disseminated that to the team and how you worked through it to kind of get into this, okay, we got a plan B and this is going to be our plan A.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's, you have like this life moment, you remember right where you were when something happened, usually it's a bad thing. But in this case, I remember being at my laptop, got a Google chat from one of my colleagues. And he said, if this says what I think it is, like third-party cookies are going away. And this like means a lot to us for a lot of, and I read the article and it was just, that stop moment. I think the article even said something like, we'll require brands to use more first-party data, which is not widely available. I'm like, it is, but it is, we have it. And so it was definitely that moment where I thought, okay, let's get in the market and validate this. Let's not get, too high on our own self-esteem here, our own egos. But up until then, Huckle was a really, really great persona builder. We had clients. It was profitable. It did exactly what it was meant to do. But now it's like, wow, if we could expand this data set, 36 data points is nice. What if we could get a few hundred? And we found a way to do that. And now what if, the same guy actually shared OpenAI. So remember the first time I saw OpenAI, it's like, what if we could use this then to actually build out the marketing material? So now instead of having a team of people building out 1,000 campaigns because you have 1,000 different segments that Huckle uncovers, what if AI could build that? And then only if you could push that directly in Instagram and Facebook and Google and MailChimp. And so there were kind of those waterfalls. But that first moment of knowing almost everyone that advertised, I think it's a $600 billion industry, online advertising. Everyone does Google, Facebook, Instagram ads. And to know that every one of those advertisers is being impacted right now, and that this has already started at the start of this year, knowing that it was a race because we knew there are lots of people in the world smarter and better funded than me. And everyone that was reading that press release at the time was like, I could make a product that addresses this. And 3 years ago, there really was no competition in the market. Today, there's probably four or five new competitors right in our space that have all launched within the last 2 years since these announcements came out. But yes, I remember that moment. It was that pivot moment. It was the realization that, we can be part of something really big.
And I love how you're always looking for the next thing and how when you find it, you're able to activate it. Can you talk about the kinds of things you had to go through to actually activate your shift.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. And one of our, so we have our core values painted on the walls, but you know, one of the first one is the text underneath it is you can't change the wind, but you can adjust the sails. And so that's the very first core value. So the idea is that, you know, we are largely at the mercy of Google and regulators, probably those two forces. We can't pass privacy regulation or stop it. We can't prevent Google from enabling or disabling third-party cookies. When those do those things, we can shift our sails. And so that was, you know, that phrase is always in my head. When I see something disruptive, I think, okay, can't change that. I can change how we respond to it. So in that case, understanding we had a product that was about 30% to solving that problem. But if I showed you the version of Huckle that we had the day I saw that announcement, you would say, I don't get it. How does that solve this problem? You know, there wasn't enough data points. It didn't integrate with ad platforms. There was no AI involved. So first was sitting down and saying, okay, there is a connection here. This product could be part of the solution, but it's only 30% of the way there. So then we start plugging in the other, you know, 70%. So we found, how do we get those additional data points? Well, we found a great partner that can license and aggregate that data. And so we signed a deal with them. We found a great development partner who could help us build that out. We actually worked through Jumpstart, and they're both Ohio guys. So Jumpstart in Cleveland was able to help us. They have a program there that allowed us to fund the development without, you know, losing any equity in the company. So we were able to build that. So we really put together all the basics we learned in business school, right? How do you pay for it? Well, what's the product side? What's the funding strategy? What's the sales and marketing strategy? And empowering the team. So there is a whole Huckle task force that meets every week and offline and individually more often than that, but as a team. So there's a dev lead, and you know, he's empowered to make those dev decisions. There's a finance lead. He's empowered to make the funding decisions. There's a sales lead. There's a marketing lead. And so, you know, my job is to set the, you know, see which way the wind's blowing, figure out how to set the sails, and then have a really good crew that keeps the boat on track and get me out of that, because I'm not the finance expert. I'm not the sales guy. I couldn't write a line of code to save my life. So building out that crew then and empowering them to make the decision, then they're all manning the appropriate sales.
So that's one of the, what you just kind of lightly talked about is one of the things I see very often as a detriment to growth. And you talk about task force, but more so you have people empowered to make these decisions. And in the beginning, when you're growing, I'm sure you were this way too, as you wear, everybody wears a lot of different hats. You're sure. Trying to do what you can. But at some point there comes a time where you need to empower, you need to put the responsibility onto somebody else, and it can't be you. It can't be you for everything, right? Or else that's a problem. I want to kind of talk through that a little bit, and I'm going to make it part of this, you know, time where you had to rethink revenue too. Sure. Is how long had you had what you would consider a pretty confident team approach like that, where you had people that were empowered, knowledgeable, and could make those decisions, be accountable for those decisions? How long did you have that at your company before this pivotal moment occurred?
Right. Yeah, we had been building that team for years. So I've been, you know, I've done the thing where I start a company from the back of a napkin. Typically my wife is the first employee. So she quits her job for a year or two and, you know, kind of fills in the blanks and comes on, and then usually do contracts with 1099 grad students, because we live in Columbus and there's a great talent pool here a few miles from our office. So that's, you know, that's typically the model until there's enough financial stability to start hiring people. And I'm of the mindset that even as a small business with two or three employees, you should have health insurance, you should have a 401k. So I generally wait until there's enough cash in the bank to offer those sorts of things. But in 2014, I started Futurity. It was 2017. So it was 3 years before we made our first full-time hires. And then from there, then those first two folks are still with me today. If you're familiar with EOS and Traction, hire implementer right away. So very first hire was our implementer. He still does that role to this day. And then our lead data guy. So we had, you know, that core team is still here, built around them. So I said it was 2017, and right away start empowering folks. We have a really diverse mix of people earlier in their career and a lot of more senior people. So I think that balance helps. You know, recently our focus has been a little bit more on some of the more senior folks, just because it allows us to ramp up a little quicker and, you know, get some of them plugged into the roles really fast. But, you know, on the Huckle team, I would say two or three of those folks are very early career, you know, Futurity is an early part of their career, but they had been with us for years. So I think our dev guys on year three, our marketing person is year three, sales guys on year three. So I would say they were, you know, they were being prepared for those positions in advance of this. I would say that I think all three of them, if they were on this, would say this is the biggest project they've ever taken on in their career, because it's the biggest one I've taken on, certainly. And I'm, you know, 2 decades older than them. So I think they're all, you know, they enjoy the challenge. They enjoy being pushed. But is it a stretch? Absolutely. It's a stretch.
Very impressive. So, Bill, let's talk about this big project. I mean, how do you, as an entrepreneur, how do you think about, you've talked about this idea that you're in a race. You're not as big or as well funded. You've got this gigantic opportunity. You've got a lot of young folks haven't been there, done that the way you have necessarily, although you're bringing more of those folks on board. How do you develop the process for attacking the market? How do you think about it? How do you get the most out of your team and out of the opportunity that's in front of you?
Yeah, great question. And it's something I think about all the time. So one, I rely on mentors. So I've got three really great mentors that have all been there and done that. You know, I encourage anyone to do this. There's a problem I could spend 6 weeks trying to solve, and I would still probably pick the wrong answer, but I could call one of my mentors and they can tell me what the answer is in 5 minutes. You know, they could say, hey, I've been here, Bill. I've been here trying to launch this product against better funded, more established companies. We tried 5 things. Here's the one that worked. And they have just saved me weeks of my life and tens of thousands of dollars to get to the answer. So one of the biggest things I do is it's almost like having a time machine, like having those mentors who are that far ahead of me in their careers who have already solved these same problems. And then knowing my own weaknesses, you know, I know that, you know, process and discipline and organization are not my strong suits. So one of the hires we just made this year was he's acting in like a CFO, VP of strategy type role who, probably has about 10 years experience on me and has built companies from a few million to 100 million, and he's done that before. He knows the playbook. He knows the drill. I can stumble my way through and try to figure it out, and there's maybe a 1 in 10 shot I'd figure it out on the first time, but he's done it. And so he's become a really integral part of the team too. So understanding, you know, I could have taken the money that I spent on some of these salaries and say, let's go raise some money and let's go try to put it in the product. Or I could say, let's build the right team first and then make much smarter decisions instead of throwing darts at what the product or the process should be. So put the team first, pay for the experience, pay for the people that have solved the problems. Recognize you're not the smartest person in the room. You know, put surround yourself with just better, more experienced, smarter people.
This is what I love about growing teams and growing an organization, is that there may be some high level strategies you want to employ, but I love the diversity of talent, and diversity not just in different perspectives and upbringing, cultural upbringing, gender, things like that. I think about diversity in terms of experience too. I've found the best teams that work well together are the ones that have a good blend of entry-level talent, mid-career talent, and experienced industry vet talent. And when you're building sales teams, when you're building customer-facing teams, or in the case of leadership team, is the team just thrives better when it's that way, as opposed to just one or the other. I've seen companies hire just industry vets as their leadership team, and they stumble, just like U.S. Olympic basketball team from
20 years ago.
That just remarkably the greatest talent in the world and couldn't win a game, or won very few. So I like that you called that out and kind of talking through it, and James, that you kind of teed it up about bringing on talent like that, because that's a really hard part about growing company, especially at different milestones, whether you're adding a first or second employee, but now you're looking at adding levels of leaders or a level of leader or somebody on your team. So talk about that for a second. Was that intentional for you, or was that just a byproduct of, who you are and the people that you surround yourself with and kind of building that team from the different levels of experience?
Right. It has been a very deliberate focus, especially the last year. And I will say, early on, because a lot of what we do, there aren't people, I think the three of us are roughly the same generation. There aren't a lot of people our age that have degrees in data analytics and a background using Tableau and Microsoft BI. And just by default of that, most of the people with those skills are under 30. You know, it's a relatively newer technology. These programs are relatively new in schools. So I don't even know if when I was in college there was there wasn't a machine learning or AI degree. There probably wasn't a data analytics one, or if so, I wasn't bright enough to
get it. Or if so, it was at Harvard and that was it.
Yes, exactly. Right, exactly. It was a super elite. Now I'm sure most community colleges have a data analytics program. I'm sure they do. So in some ways, our team for probably too long skewed too young. And so we had an experience, I guess, an experience more than age specifically. And I think that you miss context sometimes. So you're talking to you may have all the technical skills in the world, but you're talking to a CEO or CMO at a large healthcare system, and you just don't have the you don't understand why they just can't get to the data file, or why they just can't sign off on the access documents, and that there's, you know, layers of complexity there that you don't understand. So it was very deliberately, you know, the last year, 18 months, that we set to balance it the other direction with more some mid-career and even senior level folks. And I think we're at that right point now, because we even our leadership team has someone who is, this is her first job. She's, you know, in her mid-20s. And then there's someone who's 10 years older than me. So our leadership team does represent that age diversity very well. And everyone has an equal voice, regardless of, you know, seniority or age or experience. So I think we have woven that fabric in pretty well. But I can tell you, it was a deliberate choice. When I looked at the stuff we weren't great at and that we needed help with, it came down to just someone who could bring a little more context, a little more experience, a little more empathy and collaboration with our context.
I love the fact that you give us clues around kind of how you behave in terms of the mentors and coaches that you employ. It gives me a sense of the type of culture that you're building, which is, I think the word collaborative makes a lot of sense, but this idea that everyone has an equal voice, it's not one where, as Ed was saying, you know, we're going to hire this high performer, just let them go, do their thing. And it really creates an environment where you're rewarding heroes and folks who are going to be less collaborative and just more, you know, just bulldoze their way through and make things happen, as if the team wasn't important, as if the organization didn't require a sustainable culture to get to its goal.
Right. I just wrote about this today on LinkedIn, but it's, again, two of my mentors have said this in different ways. One was pretty harsh. One was a little more kind, but essentially, you know, you have a list of everyone in your company, and in one column are givers and one are takers. So givers, as the small business owner, CEO, the givers are the one that come into your office and say, hey, I'm concerned about Johnny in sales. I think maybe, you know, he's going through some stuff at home. I think we need to, like, just kind of help him out a little bit, pitch in. Or so-and-so in HR, just, you know, they just had a relative pass away. We should get the sympathy card going. Or, hey, it's almost Cinco de Mayo. Can we organize margaritas and tacos after work? You know, it's the people that, and that's the, you know, the extraneous stuff. It's also could be the business stuff of, hey, I see this opportunity we should pursue. Or I think we could gain some efficiencies here. Those are the givers. They put stuff into the culture to lift everyone else out, that servant leadership. And then the takers, and every small business owner's had this, the person that walks in their office and you just, you know, you immediately tense up because they want a bigger monitor. They think the vacation policy is not fair. They're, you know, it's what can other people do for me? And, you know, my one friend that I just talked to this weekend, you know, she said that the punchline was reward the givers and mentor the takers. So a much kinder approach. I have a friend who I think you guys probably know too. He's kind of a turnaround CEO. He comes in usually when companies are in trouble, and his philosophy is you fire all the takers. And when you turn around a company, then you have a community just of givers. So it's a much more drastic. So I'm not quite that extreme, but I think if you mentor those that say, like, hey, look, you know, and you make it very clear, like, here's people that give and reward, and they're the ones that they're on the leadership. That's a requirement to be on a leadership team here. Like, no matter how great you are at your job, if you're not a giver, you're not on the leadership team, because that's the cultural tone we want to set. And I think just reinforcing that salaries, bonuses, promotions are really tied to people that it's not just about you wanting to be at Futurity or at any company. It's about you're the reason other people want to be at Futurity. They want to be here because of you, because of who you are. That's the kind of people that we want to reward and you know, reinforce that behavior.
Well said. Well said, Bill.
Yeah, that's a very intentional way to do this. And whether it's shaped from your personal experiences or through others, through the mentors that you've got and the friends that you've got, to just, this is the whole learning world that we're in. And over the years, I've learned that the best laid plans or the best executed plans are ones that are intentional and purposeful. There's a reason why, and it's beyond just surface level things like, oh, we want to grow, we want to attack the market, we need to get funding, whatever the case may be. But when it's very intentional and purposeful like this, the giver taker, what you want on your team, when, I think those are things that probably don't get talked enough about, quite frankly. There's probably not a whole lot of press around things like that, but boy, is it a differentiator when you're starting to think about team dynamics and jiving and how do people work. And exactly like what you said is, do people want to work there because of other factors? And how do you bring those other factors in? So that's a great comment. Thank you for that. Well, as we start to wrap up, there's something I want to kind of hear from you is, now that you've had this recent strategy up evil of right. what you were going to do, big project, now had to take a turn. What's on the docket for this year in terms of sales and marketing? Is it getting into these regulated industries deeper? Are the couple that you're real bullish on right now that you want to dive into a little deeper than you're in right now? Or what are some of the top initiatives that you're really focused on this year as it relates to sales and marketing?
Yeah, great question. Something, you know, at my heart, I'm a like marketing and salesperson. So this is the part of the business I get really excited about. And what we have found is, it's that high level air cover of marketing that is getting us new business. So it's things like this. We do a podcast almost every week. You know, our marketing person does a great job getting us scheduled on podcasts and media interviews. We're in the local business publications pretty consistently, and then industry ones in hospital and healthcare pretty consistently. The speaker opportunities, we're doing those again almost one a week. Awards, you know, best places to work or Fast 50 or Inc. 5000. So that high level air cover has been more effective for us than the direct sales outreach so far, getting us to this point. And part of that, you know, like in the hospital system, there are, I think, about 3,000 hospitals in the US. There's probably about 40 or 50 that are part of these systems that we really want to work with. And we work with, I think, six today. So that's a known universe. So if we know, well, let's go where those individuals are. Let's make sure we're in the magazines they're reading. We're on the podcast they listen to. We're speaking at the conferences they attend. So it gives us, there is a luxury of having those really specific niches. That said, that activity and that branding, that awareness also create related opportunities or peripheral accounts. So we'll get, you know, every time we do an event like this or any kind of media, it always results in great conversations and follow-up. So that's our, you know, our determined, absolutely go for it goal is just continue to focus on that broad awareness, that connection. Understanding, you know, I like to fish, and there's a kind of one of the famous sayings in fishing is you can't catch fish where there aren't fish. So you have all the technique, you've got the right bait, the right lures, everything else. But if there's not a fish under that tree, it doesn't matter how well you fish. So our opportunities now, we know where our fish are, and we're just going to keep working that spot, you know, over and over and over again to catch the fish out. And every once in a while, we'll overcast this way, or someone else swims in and we'll catch another fish, and that's great too. But for now, we know that's the plan. If we go to, you know, there's talk of, do we just really, really go extra big this year? You know, we're growing at 30, 40, 50%. So that's like normal for us right now. If we go like, what does it take to grow 200%? You know, that's when we're looking at, okay, now we're going to activate a team of outbound in addition to this targeted list. And so that's the, you know, kind of critical decision we're weighing right now versus, you know, continuing to grow at 40 or 50% is still a big, big number, but we can do that with the plan we have in place now. If we really want, you know, 200% growth, that's going to require, I think, an additional component.
Outstanding. Bill, we've talked about leadership, core values, culture, hiring, a lot of great stuff. I wonder though, if this conversation has kind of elevated a thought that you'd like to share with our listeners, maybe a bit of advice that they can use as they embark on their own process to rethink revenue.
Sure. I'll come back to one of our core values, and that's relentless forward movement. So the idea is that ideas are great and everyone has a good idea, but it comes down to that movement and that execution. So you got to keep pushing forward, taking the activity, take the next steps. When you asked me, you know, what did we do when we saw the opportunity for Huckle? You know, the fact is probably 1,000 people saw that news that Google announced and said, I should make a first party cookie, you know, ad tech platform. It's, you know, it was doable for a lot of people, but you've got to make those steps of how do I acquire the data? How do we get the right team in place? How do you get the dev shop in place? And so my biggest advice is just keep moving forward. And if you feel like you're spinning your wheels and you're not moving, talk to someone else, get another set of opinions, you know, get in front of a whiteboard, but you've got to keep forward movement, no matter what.
Yeah, I love that too. And it's something I've recognized at times in my past that I'm stuck. I feel like I'm stuck and things aren't moving and I'm either overthinking things or right. trying to like build the perfect MVP. And
right.
so I've recognized that. And I think that's this, I think that's a great value to embody in just to keep moving forward. And I don't quite subscribe to the fail fast, fail forward, because right. I don't like to fail fast, but I do like the forward.
Yes.
Like every mistake, every misstep, that debrief needs to happen and say, what could we have done better? And then let's do better and move forward instead of like, let's not do it. So
right.
I love that that's part of your core value. core values, as long in addition to the wind and the sail analogy, I think is important about what you can control versus what you can't, because what you can't control can very deliberately cause indecision paralysis. So I like that those two values are there to really support each other. So that's awesome. Bill, this has been great. The time, I just looked at the time maybe 5 minutes ago and I was like, oh wow, this is this is going really long. So thank you for this. Thank you for the time. Thank you for the insight. Where can you've talked a little bit about Huckle and Futurity, but where can people find you and the company and engage with any of the information that you've got? Where can people find you?
Great. Yeah. Always connect with me on LinkedIn. I think I'm the only Bill Balderas out there. So it's Balderaz. I'm sure it's in the show notes too. So the blessing of having a unique name. And then Futurity.com, which is just futurety.com, or HuckleInsights.com are the two websites to find us.
Okay, great. I will throw those there. And for the audience listening, Bill is very active on LinkedIn. He posts some very good thought-provoking content that I've enjoyed, I've followed along with. So if you really want to hear a lot more about what he's been talking about on this show, he is active on LinkedIn and talking about it. So please do. So on that note, thank you again for your time, James. It's been good.
I'm pleasure.
Looking forward to seeing you in person outside sometime. So this will be
vitamin D.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So we'll look forward to that. And then for everyone tuning in, thank you so much for your time. And we will see you on another episode.